Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Mathematics. Our guest today is John Allen Paulos, a mathematics professor and best-selling author who is probably known to many of you for his books, Enumeracy and A Mathematician Reads the Newspaper. John's latest endeavor is Enumerate Life, a fascinating venture intriguingly described by the book's subtitle, A Mathematician Explores the Vagaries of Life, His Own and Probably Yours. John, welcome to the show.
Jim, it's a pleasure. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, John. John, what gave you the idea for writing this book?
Well, many of my books combine disparate disciplines. Mathematics, one of them always, but something else. And sometimes it seems weird. I mean, people say math and biography in this particular case, but I've written about math and humor, math and journalism, math in the stock market, but nevertheless, as has often been said, fish don't need bicycles and flashlights don't use solar power and biographies don't seem to need or use mathematics. So it's my burden in this book to show how mathematical notions can illuminate certain aspects of our life stories.
Yeah, that's what really surprised me when I read in the introductions that one of your reasons for writing the book was to focus the mathematical lens on the topic of biography, because I sure hadn't seen that. I enjoyed your anecdote about numerical estimation and how it affected your belief in Santa Claus. I think our audience would enjoy it as well.
Okay. No, early on I was a skeptic, and it seems like a too pat a memory for an author of a book like Enumeracy to have, but I do very distinctly remember at a very young age, a toddler, not believing in Santa Claus, and the reason was kind of quantitative in a very loose sense reasoning. I mean, how can he go down all those chimneys, stop and have a hot chocolate at all of them, and so on. And so concluded, no, that's impossible. But I oddly was very concerned about my parents, who seemed to kind of get off on my on Santa Claus and Christmas. So I kept my skepticism from them, even though I was 3 or 4 years old, so as not to disappoint them.
Yeah, you sure don't want to disillusion your parents.
No. But I mean, but that sort of thing, I did a lot. I mean, I remember in elementary school, we'd be talking about World War II, and I remember this girl. I even remember her name, but I won't mention it now, not that she's public or anything. But she said, do all the citizens of a foreign country on the losing side of a war, are they all killed? And all the soldiers killed? And I thought to myself, no, you don't go to these Saturday matinee B movies about World War II, do you? I mean, that just seemed also absurdly enumerate, although, of course, I didn't know the word then. So a tendency to just count things I had from very early on, including counting my father's cigarettes in a pack of cigarettes with my grubby toddler hands full of peanut butter. And I was amused to note that every pack contained 20 cigarettes. He was probably less amused to find peanut butter on his cigarettes.
Yeah, well, just so long as you aren't lighting them. Anyway,
yeah, no.
The pleasures and obsessions of counting permeate your book. Many mathematicians I have met take pleasure in counting. I actually have found that many children love to count, but somehow that pleasure erodes as they grow older. Here's a really big question. Your book in Numeracy put a word into the English language that perfectly described a phenomenon of which many math teachers were aware. How does the state of enumeracy now compare with when you wrote the book, and what suggestions would you make to alleviate it?
I think it's very difficult to make such generalizations. Certainly, there are pockets of excellence in schools throughout the country, and also maybe larger pockets of not such excellent instruction. People always ask about pedagogy and the ideal pedagogy and Common Core. In general, I'm in favor of the Common Core, but it needn't be all that common. I mean, people learn in different ways. I mean, one of the most influential teachers I had certainly didn't subscribe to any advanced notion of pedagogy. In fact, he was kind of a martinet, kind of a bully. I tell a story in Enumeracy and repeat it here, but he was, we were talking about sports. I think I was 10 or 11 years old, about fourth grade, fifth grade. And we each had to say something that interested us about sports. And I said that there was a pitcher for the Milwaukee Braves who got only one man out and allowed five unearned runs. So I said his earned run average was 135. And because five divided by 1/27 of a game is 135. And he started blustering, and my voice was quavering, my hands were shaking, my face got red. And he said, "You can't have an earned run average more than 27. Sit down, John, sit down. You don't know what you're talking about." Anyway, it stung me. And later in the season, this pitcher never pitched again. And the Milwaukee Journal published the final statistics for anybody who played for the Braves that year. And it said, sure enough, he had an earned run average of 135. So I brought it up to him and showed him. And he said, "Oh, sit down, sit down. You don't know what you're..." No, he didn't say, "You don't know what you're talking about. Sit down, sit down." But anyway, it was clear to me that I was right. And what was even more clear to me was that he knew I was right. So, I mean, I realized at that time there's a kind of power that mathematics confers on people, or can confer on people. That, and even though I was small and slight in a way, and he was big and had a bulbous red nose, I was right, he was wrong, and he knew it. So that kind of contributed to my fascination with mathematics. And it's not, it's clear, it's not a great pedagogical practice, but somehow showing how mathematics and a bit of logic and some facts can actually vanquish bullies and blowhards, I think it sometimes work. It can be more effective than figuring out the height of a flagpole across a river. So, I hesitate to say one or the other curriculum or pedagogy is ideal. People learn in different ways. But in general, I think I can say that an emphasis on understanding, on cognition, on the qualitative appreciation of ideas is more conducive to mathematics, to people going on in mathematics, than is a focus on rote procedures. 100 long division problems in elementary school, 100 polynomials to factor in middle school, 100 functions to differentiate in high school or college. That can be stultifying, mind-numbing. And happily, with the technology and various apps and software, that can be minimized. I mean, you still should have some of it so you know what the software is doing, but the emphasis can be placed on understanding, on games, on graphs, on serious mathematical notions and mathematical thinking, model making, and so on. So, and I think that is more the case now than it was 25 years ago. But
I certainly think you're right. I certainly think you're right. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about your book is the way that advanced topics from mathematics are interspersed through the narrative in such a way that I think the reader gets an appreciation of these topics as well. For instance, you had an explanation of why we're all strange given in terms of the fraction of a geometrical object in which the normal people reside. It's an intriguing way to illustrate not only that we're all strange, I certainly am, but we're all able to appreciate the n-dimensional geometry without being able to visualize it.
What I try to do is kind of go back and forth in the book. I mean, looking at certain vignettes, incidents in my life, and using them as jumping off points to discuss the mathematics that sheds light on all lives, I guess. So it's kind of this back and forth between the personal and the abstract. And as far as the topic you just mentioned, I was struck by a saying that my father always would make, and he said that there are two kinds of people in the world, those who are very strange and those whom we don't know very well. So I mean, basically the idea is the following. Imagine you have a straight line that's 10 inches long. If you cut out the half an inch on either end, what's left is 9 inches. So there's about an inch close to the 10% close to the edge. But now if you make it a square that's 10 inches long and subtract the half an inch from each of the sides, that's 80.9 times 0.9, or 9 times 9, 81 square inches, let's say 10 inches, over 100 square inches. The edge now constitutes 19% of the area. You go up a dimension, you have a cube that's 10 inches on a side. Just take off the edges that are within a half an inch of the surface, and you have 9 times 9 times 9, 729 over 1,000. So it's only 73% is in the interior, and 27% is along the edge, close to the edge. And you can look at higher dimensions. I mean, everybody can be measured along countless dimensions. And when you get to an n-dimensional hypercube or hypersphere, if you want to do with spheres, the percentage of the hypervolume that's in the edge is essentially all of it. And the part of it that's in the interior is essentially none of it. So the edge is within one half inch of the border, and you can even reduce that to a tenth of an inch or a hundredth of an inch or whatever, because there are so many dimensions. And we can conclude, it's kind of hard to see without a little diagram, but we can conclude that virtually everybody is in the edge of n-dimensional hypercube for very high n. So at least along some dimensions, we're all very strange, and that's consistent with this kind of metaphor for strangeness. And you can do the same thing with probability instead of with elementary geometry. But again, the thing that motivated this is I remember I met this, I knew this very peripherally, knew this guy in graduate school, and he was very conservative, always dressed in a sport coat and tie, and seemed quite boring, unimaginative, conservative, and that's all. All I knew about him. And one day, downtown Madison, I see him hiding behind a building, and then I noticed people bending down to try to pick something up and failing, and he would giggle behind the building. And I walked by, and I saw there was a $10 bill on the sidewalk, but it was heavily shellacked, so you couldn't pick it up. So he somehow got a kick out of people trying to pick up this $10 bill, which he had shellacked to the sidewalk or somehow fastened to the sidewalk. And he was always giggling at everybody's attempt. So again, here's somebody who's the most banal of people, at least on the surface, and it was very, very strange. And in my experience, the little quip that I mentioned, everybody, two kinds of people in the world, the very strange and the ones you don't know very well, is more or less true. Like, when I find out more about a person, they're generally, you know, along most dimensions, I'm sure within a normal range, but so many dimensions, everyone's really weird along some of them.
You have some absolutely wonderful quotes throughout the book. I just love good quotes. And one of this really appealed to me. Statisticians, like artists, have the bad habit of falling in love with their models.
Yeah, that's George Box, the statistician, writes it, but it's his quote. But yeah, no, people use models in outside their range of application, and in simple cases, it's clear that it doesn't work. I mean, even 2 and 2 equals 4. If you can misapply that and use it as an inappropriate model. If you take 2 cups of water and add it to 2 cups of popcorn, you get 3 cups of soggy water, not 4. So in that sense, 2 and 2 is 3. It's the inappropriate model. Or there's the tribe that used to go bear hunting and became extinct shortly thereafter, mastering vector analysis. And the reason is, before vector analysis, if they saw a bear to the northwest, they'd shoot it with their arrow and they'd have a feast. But after mastering vector analysis, if they would shoot one arrow to the north and one arrow to the west, and the bear would get away. So, again, it's an inappropriate model. And in these cases, it's quite clear what's wrong. But if you're using some kind of esoteric mathematics, some kind of dynamics or some kind of complicated regressions in statistics, it's not so clear when the model that's being used is inappropriate and you know, that doesn't work.
Well, one of the comparisons that you made in the book, which really intrigued me, involves some very deep mathematics between Gödel's incompleteness theorem and self-reference as it appears in autobiography.
Right. It's. When you're talking about incompleteness theorem, I mean, it's hard to be too concise about it. But basically, you're assigning a code to statements in arithmetic, and the statements are about numbers. But if you interpret them via this code, you can code for something follows from something else. Something is. Is a conjunction, something is whatever. So you can talk metamath. The statements that are about numbers can be interpreted at a meta level as being about the system itself. If you artfully supply the code and make sure everything is recursive and so on. And in a way, that's what we do. You can think of cognition that way. The analog of talk about numbers, the lower level kind of machine language, is neurons talking to each other. And that's fine. But at a higher level, the neurons are also referring to themselves, referring to the system, the brain of which they're a part, the person, the eye of which they're a part. So you've got this bifocal view of things, and numbers versus metamathematical comments about the system in which numbers exist. And here you have neuronal commotion of neurons on the lower level, and yet at a higher level, they're saying something. They're forming concepts which relate to things in the outside world, and self-referential comments, the I, in the same way that the Gödel's theorem depends on self-referential comments, and says, in a sense, that this statement is not provable.
Yeah, you know, one of the things about your book is that you emphasize that mathematical concepts arise from visceral experiences. And that's what I always try to emphasize in my courses. And you progress from there to the notion that constructing an autobiography is similar to curve fitting. And I found that intriguing. And maybe you could discuss that a little.
Well, I mean, one kind of common activity and statistics is creating the line or the curve of best fit, given a bunch of points in a plane or or a three-dimensional region or a higher dimensional region, you want to find the curve or surface of best fit. You don't want too many too far away from the curve or surface, and you want to minimize those deviations and so on. And in a sense, without diminishing the complexity of people's lives, that's what you do when you, to some extent, when you tell a person's life story, when you construct a biography. There's a certain set of incidents, and you want to construct the narrative that kind of best captures those incidents, and you don't want too many of them to be too far away from the biography, that is the kind of narrative surface. And and in statistics, there are ways to do that. You want to minimize the squares of the deviations and so on. So informally, we do that as well when we're telling biographies. And we only have a few incidents to work with, and the rest is inference and guessing and going on from there.
There are a number of really interesting and intriguing anecdotes that permeate your book, and there are a couple that I'm certainly want to discuss. And one of them was the anecdote about your childhood experience of being totally immersed in the moment and pointing out the trade-off between the payoffs for prudence and the pleasure of immersion, as exhibited by the young girl on the motorbike in Bangkok.
That's interesting that you like that. The experience was I was walking down a narrow soi, which is Thai for alley or small street, and I noticed this young Thai woman on a big motorcycle. It was much too big for her, and on the back of it were her three small children. And there was an overhanging the street. The alley went through a grove of trees, and a tree was branch was hanging down with some very fragrant flowers that I could smell even from where I was. And she stopped the motorcycle and put her leg out to support it, and pulled the branch down and smelled it, and really seemed moved by the smell, and she gave it to each of her three kids, and they inhaled it, and she had this beatific smile on her face. But her leg was extending out, and it was a narrow street, so cars were going by and just barely missing her foot, and she was completely oblivious to the danger she was in. But it struck me as kind of a trade-off to being really in the moment, as she seemed to be, and being prudent. And often there's a trade-off. If you're too prudent or too cognizant of your surroundings and what you can do to maximize this and maximize that, you do tend to not be in the moment. And the incident reminded me of a couple in my early childhood where I was in the moment instead of observing somebody else. But in any case, and even though it seems strange, like what does that have to do with math? Again, what I did is take incidents and then use them as jumping off points. So I took some little event that had a huge consequence, and then I used that to talk about the butterfly effect and small differences in initial conditions leading to huge differences later on. Or I talk about probability and why and mistakes people make, and then why what relevant notions from formal probability are relevant, or even crushes, romantic crushes, and Bayesian statistics. I mean, when you first meet somebody and you develop a crush on them, the prior probability, so to speak, is that this person is wonderful, is flawless, is this, is that. And gradually, as you come to meet them, you are disabused of these idealistic romantic notions, and you, in a sense, use an informal version of Bayes' theorem to revise your initial opinions. As more information comes in, you change your estimate of the likelihood of this or that, or your attitude toward this or that. So
I was just reminded at this stage that there's a wonderful story about how you met your wife, and I know our listeners would enjoy listening to it, but I want to make sure that I get in your thoughts on some other topics as well. But I just loved how you met your wife.
I met her in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and we were at a Vietnam War demonstration, and the police started using tear gas, and everyone scattered and ran, and she and I happened to run in the same direction, and our eyes were stinging, wasn't it? There was a water fountain there, and I very gallantly, I guess, held the water fountain open so she, Sheila's her name, could wash out her eyes before I washed out mine. And then we decided to go out. We went to an Italian restaurant we were sitting talking, and we had given our order, and it took a long time, and we didn't know why. And Sheila said, maybe they'll come and deliver it if I knock this Coke bottle. We had ordered Coke. I knock it on the floor. And I said, no, don't do that. She said, yeah, no, he's taken half an hour. It was a simple order. So she gradually edged the Coke bottle near the end of it to the end of the table, and it, of course, crashed on the floor. And everybody ran over, including the waiter, and tried to clean it up immediately and apologize for her. She didn't even say anything about the food, but they brought the food immediately. But anyway, this kind of I was smitten by this, and talk about romantic crushes. That seemed like a really appealing thing to do.
Well, you discuss something called robo-romance, romance between human-robot amalgams. And as you were doing so, I don't know whether or not you're familiar with Data in Star Trek, The Next Generation, but Data is sort of like, I think it's, the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz, who wants to be human, wants to get a heart. And one of the things that Data is trying to do is acquire some knowledge and possibly involvement with romance. You suggest that seduction or romance might depend upon how these creatures, these human-robot amalgams, react to their and each other biographies. But isn't that what we do with human beings?
Yes, in a sense. But, will we be nothing more than universal Turing machines with different capacities, different fleshware, different speeds? I don't know. What if some of the readership of a biography, to get back to biography, operates with a different version of the software than that of the protagonist? And what happens when memories can be tweaked, changed, implanted, or even deleted? And that's not so unlikely. I have an example of a story that comes to mind. It's, as I say in the book, it's retro, futuristic, and a little silly, but it's germane to these more weighty considerations. Imagine a kind of logical seduction by a super enhanced machine. And the super enhanced human male, let's say, were to brag about his various system upgrades and familiarity with many technical matters while flirting with a human female, whose software and hardware enhancements compelled her to be totally, absolutely, scrupulously honest. And that could be the case. And of course, the assumptions underlying this can be changed and sexist and whatever, but let's go with the man trying to con the woman, which could go the other way around, of course. After a while, he asked her, will you solemnly promise to give me right now your telephone number if I make a true statement? And conversely, not give me your number if I make a false statement? And feeling that this is kind of a flattering, benign request, and not so strange given the man's background, the woman promises to give him her telephone number if and only if he makes a true statement. And the man then makes this statement: "You will neither give me your telephone number now, nor will you sleep with me tonight." And the woman flustered a little bit, and she thinks through her options. She realizes that the statement is either true or false, and that if it's true, the statement says that she won't give him her telephone number. But if it's false, she must not give him her number because of her promise to give it to him only if he makes a true statement. And so whether the statement is true or false, she won't give him her number. So she won't give him her number under any circumstances. But if she refuses to sleep with him, the statement becomes true. And this would require her to give him her number, which she can't do. The only way she can keep her promise is to sleep with him so that his statement becomes false. And the woman's seemingly innocuous promise ensnares her. And we can all be similarly ensnared by bad software. And it's hard to follow such a train of logic hearing it.
Yeah, but when you're talking about it, but when you read about it, you can certainly do it. But this doesn't seem like the world's greatest pickup line in the 21st century. Maybe we have to wait a few centuries for it.
Yeah, I suspect the class of unenhanced people for whom this seduction approach would work is still rather tiny.
Well, I only had one instance in my entire life in which, when I was introduced as a mathematician, a young lady's eyes lit up. And after she learned that I was a mathematician, she said, you know, I've always wanted to be a mathematician. And so I'm stunned because nobody wants to meet mathematicians, especially attractive girls. And then she said, tell me, why is 9 the master number? And I knew she was interested in numerology rather than mathematics.
Yeah, that's a problem. I sometimes come across. People, see the title to my previous book, Innumeracy, and actually even in this book, and they say, "Oh, I'm interested in numerology too. You must. Are you this or that? Are you a Capricorn and whatever?" So.
Yeah, there's a confusion here. And also, in your discussion of probability, you bring up an idea you call the fundamental confusion of coincidences, which results in a lot of muddled thinking.
Yeah, the fundamental confusion is the following. People often ask me, what's the likelihood of some sequence of events, this, that, and that? And the answer, of course, is it's anytime you ask about a specific event or a specific sequence of events, the probability is almost always tiny, minuscule. But the right question to ask is, what's the probability of something of this general sort occurring? And that, it's hard to define the general sort, but relying on a rough idea of what it might mean, that probability is always very high. So the probability of a general event of this sort occurring is quite high. I mean, there's standard ways to generate examples. You look at the first letters of the planets, or Mercury, Venus, Earth, MVE, and then Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. As you continue, the word sun appears if you look at the first letters of the planet in order of their distance from the sun. And Saturn, Uranus, Neptune at the end, and the word sun appears. Or the first letters of the months, January, February, March, April, and so on. You have July, August, September, October, November. The word Jason appears. Is that significant? No. And if you ask beforehand, if some sequence of letters, you have a dial, let's say, with the 26 letters of the alphabet that are on the periphery, and you spin it 100 times, the probability that the word cat will appear in that 100-letter sequence in orders is small. Likewise for the probability the word dog will appear. Likewise for the probability, of course, that the word chrysanthemum will appear. But the probability of some word of at least 3 or 4 letters will appear is quite high. So the probability of a particular word is always, a particular event is almost always tiny. The probability of something of that general sort, or some word, is very high, and people confuse these two, and
there was a book a few years ago called The Bible Code, in which what they did was they did a whole bunch of things like this, and They look at all the various different possible ways you can go through the Bible according to various different letter sequences, and they come up with some astounding predictions. And then somebody else went through, I think it was War and Peace, and came up with equally astounding predictions. And right. That's just what happens is when you look at a lot of stuff like this, sooner or later, something appears and you say, wow. And that's actually an example of the fundamental confusion of coincidences.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I even wrote a piece once about how the Clinton sex scandal, Bill Clinton sex scandal was coded for in the U.S. Constitution. And you look and then you look for a so-called equidistant letter sequence for Bill. B, 18 letters later is I, 18 letters later is L, 18 letters later is it. Another L. And then you look for Lewinsky and or Monica. Here's an M, 37 letters later is an O, 37 letters and so on. And you find the two, and they're in fairly close proximity, and you say, see? Or they're not in close proximity. If not, you look for longer sequences. And you don't have to go forward. You could go forwards, backwards, diagonally. And if you look hard enough, and then you don't even have to look for Monica. You can look for Kathleen or Jennifer or whatever. you look hard enough, you'll find something. And then after you find it, it seems so unlikely. What's the likelihood that you'll see those letters in an equidistant letter sequence here and nearby there? And the answer is tiny. But if you look through the whole thing and you look hard enough, you'll find it. And that is a good example of the fundamental confusion regarding probability.
You know, John, you're probably one of the few mathematicians who has achieved any degree of widespread recognition beyond the narrow world of mathematics. And your experiences from the writing of the book Innumeracy probably parallel those of people who were suddenly catapulted into widespread recognition. A number of years later, you wrote a book called Irreligion, and I wasn't surprised to learn that a book on a touchy subject such as religion could generate hate mail. It surprised me to learn that Innumeracy did as well.
Yeah, I think, I did. I get letters with bullseyes on my forehead or anti-Semitic screeds or schizophrenic ramblings. But I think it's just a matter of multiplication. If you reach a large number of people, even if only a tiny percentage of them are kind of crazy, for lack of a
crazy is a good word here.
Yeah. So, a tiny percentage times a very large number still yields, 25 crazy letters or calls or whatever.
Were any of these, one of the things that we worry about in this day and age is that people really do some terrible things when their minds are disturbed. And just out of curiosity, you would get hate mail, but did you ever have anything that would really constitute a major threat, do you think?
Oh, I did, yeah. In fact,
Irreligion probably would.
Pardon?
Irreligion would probably generate.
Surprisingly, Innumeracy did more than Irreligion. I think because it sold more, so it reached more people. But both of them did, but especially Innumeracy. I even called the FBI because I kept getting this, seemingly threatening letters from the same guy. I know where you live. And then it was, he wrote in three different colored inks and sometimes diagonally and sometimes up and down. And then he always
sounds like some of my students.
Yeah, he always included a picture of me with a bullseye on my forehead.
Well, that they don't do with me. But yeah, I mean, this is it's a little scary because you would think that, mathematics is pretty innocuous. But I guess it isn't so much mathematics as the fact that these people are disturbed and they just, cross their radar screen.
Yeah, no, and it wasn't so much the math. I mean, I think there were like mildly snarky comments. Like in Innumeracy, I said in public context, I always use my middle name, John Alan Paulos, to distinguish myself from the then Pope, John Paul.
And,
that seemed innocuous to me, but some people took offense at that. And then I said something about 40-day flood and how much would have to fall to be, cover the earth with this much. And, it didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, well, if ever you try to do calculations like that, I've discovered that, as you probably did with your parents when you were thinking about Santa Claus, that calculations that disprove things that people believe in generate a lot of antipathy.
Oh, yeah. Because you're treading on or at least near sacred cows, and even just applying something like some notions, mathematical notions, somehow seems irreverent and inappropriate. So.
Getting to the 21st century, one of the things that exists in the 21st century that didn't exist when you wrote Innumeracy is Twitter. And you discussed the idea that Twitter and its ilk can help put together a biography by focusing on the connections people have with each other. And when I read that, I thought, good heavens, they've been doing this for ever since they wrote biography. So how does it differ from standard biography?
Well, I think it captures the evanescence of acquaintances. I mean, when people wrote standard biographies, they didn't talk about people that the protagonist might have said hello to a few times or interacted with at the corner drugstore or whatever. Whereas, you follow all kinds of people. All kinds of people follow me on Twitter. Yeah, by the way, I'm going to have engage in a Twitter war with Neil deGrasse Tyson this coming Friday. So,
is there any way we can participate in it or at least be observers?
Sure, you just go to Twitter.
Follow either one of you.
Follow either one of us and you can go from there. But, one, it captures the evanescence of everyday life. Two, because it's kind of more formal, you can apply mathematical tools and the small world phenomenon whereby, there are clusters.
And you also get
people,
the 6 degrees of separation thing.
Right. Clusters for people close together and everybody's connected to somebody distantly. And that results in the small world phenomena that results in 6 degrees of separation, fewer depending on the on what the link between people are. There's the Kevin Bacon game where if you're in the same movie as Kevin Bacon, your Bacon number is one. If you're in the same movie that somebody else was, your Bacon number is two, and so on. Same thing for Erdos numbers. If you wrote a paper with Paul Erdos, the very prolific peripatetic mathematician, your Erdos number is one. If you wrote a paper with someone who wrote a paper with Erdos, your number is two. And
that's me.
And so on. Pardon?
That's me. I wrote a paper with someone who wrote a paper with Erdos. So my Erdos
number is two. Oh, that's cool. Erdos number is four. I was working on my thesis in graduate school in Madison. I was kind of wandering through the hall at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about something. And I heard this little voice behind me and I almost yelped. Anyway, I turned around. It was Erdos, who was visiting University of Wisconsin. And, I kept from having a heart attack or yelping too much. Anyway, he asked me what I was thinking about and I told him and I was flattered to think, he offered some suggestions and it was kind of, he seemed genuinely interested his whole life was mathematics. He's known for among many things, his many papers, of course, but there's a little quip that he's a machine for turning coffee into theorems.
Yeah, I like that.
And I have a kind of parasitic, quip, which is I turn Diet Coke into paragraph.
There were a couple of other things that I wanted to talk to you about. You touch on some really important concepts in mathematics, and one of the ones that I liked was the way you phrased that most people's lives exhibit some degree of symmetry and invariance. I think that this is indicative of one thing that I would hope your book accomplishes, to make people realize that although mathematics deals with some very abstract systems and concepts, these abstractions have easy to understand examples in everyday context.
I talk about symmetry, invariance, and how it applies to human lives. I mean, even people who have very different backgrounds, very different lives, there's a certain gross similarity to their lives. I mean, they begin, they go to school or not, they embark on a career or some kind of job. And as they get older, you know, married, divorced, traveled, but their mindset tends to, after a while, be somewhat similar, even despite this seemingly different development. As they get older, their options shrink, the number of options shrink, and they tend to kind of hone in on a similar sort of mindset, a similar sort of view. And to the extent that that can be made precise, which admittedly is very vague, can be modeled in a lot of ways. One involves what is called the Kruskal card trick, whereby you ask a person to pick a special number between 0, 1, and 10, and you have a normal deck of cards, and you say, look for the first, and you don't tell him what it is. He says 3, but keep it a secret. You turn over the cards one by one. Whenever a 3 comes up, well, on the third card, rather, whatever number comes up, that's his new secret number. If the third card is a 5, then you go ahead 5 numbers. And if that card is an 8, then you go ahead 8 numbers. And whatever card that is, if it's a face card, you count all face cards as 5. And you keep on going through the deck. Almost everybody's going to end up on the same card at the end. And if you have several decks, it becomes even more likely. That's almost certain. And so there's this, and the reason is that no matter if two different people pick different initial secret numbers, they progress along this, using this rule. And sooner or later, as they jump around through the deck, they're going to alight on the same number. And from there on, they're going to move in lockstep. And in a way, life is like that, and you can modify this in various ways. You can look at it with words. You pick, let's say, the Declaration of Independence. You pick a word from the first couple of sentences, and then if it's got 7 letters, you move ahead 7 words. Then that's your new word. If it's got 3 letters, you move ahead 3 words. And if you do it artfully, you can always end on a particular word, like happiness. Or you can pick a passage from the Bible, and if you pick it artfully enough, you can always ensure that no matter what word they pick from the beginning of the passage, they'll always end on the word devil.
Okay. Yeah, you got to be really careful with this.
Or you can do it on purpose and intentionally, and you know, create a kind of religious hoax, as I talked about.
Yes,
religion.
Of course, along with the idea that we discussed regarding hate mail and innumeracy, I'm not sure that's the best idea for our listeners to pursue. But it's, if nothing else, it's very, you know, it's interesting. The idea behind the generality of the Kruskal card trick, I thought, was especially appealing because I've done the Kruskal card trick occasionally with decks of cards, but I've never done it in that particular way. And that's an intriguing idea. And actually, in a way, it's sort of what mathematics does, in that mathematics, you have an idea that applies to one area, and then all of a sudden you realize that it's much more general than you originally thought.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Actually, yeah. Talking about the development of humans throughout their life, I was feeling kind of, you know, and I see how people, when they get older, do become jaded, and sort of ways to possibly model that mathematically. I mean, I thought of the number of new records that occur. The records, record whatever performance is, all will become less frequent as you go on. I mean, one example I cite is you have somebody flip a coin 1,000 times. You might get 507 heads. That's certainly a record. You've never done it before. But you flip a coin 1,000 times again, you'll get 491 coins, let's say. 491 heads. You do it again, you get 503. Do it again, 498. Do it again, 511. Now it's a new record, but it occurred, you know, on the fifth time you flipped the coin 1,000 times. And if you keep on flipping the coin 1,000 times, maybe on the 10th time you flip it, you'll get a third new record. And then the 39th time you flip it, you get a fourth new record. On the 197th time, you get a fifth new record. But anyway, it's clear that the new records become less and less frequent. And the number of new records, if you flip the coin 1,000 times, n times, is a natural log of n. So it's a weird connection between natural log of n and e. There's a connection, a very strong connection with e. It's weird that something as personal as feeling bored or jaded can be modeled, at least in this Pickwickian sense, using the coin flips or the decreasing frequency of record performances. I mean, what stimulated this in my own life is I got a couple of awards. I got an award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science for promoting science to a large audience, and I got a comparable award from a consortium of math organizations for doing the same thing in math. I got that award a couple of years ago, and I got to thinking, you know, you get awards when you get older. lifetime achievement awards are good to receive, but also kind of reminders of one's mortality. So I got to thinking about, as I say, jadedness and so on. And the first few movies you see, it's the best movie I ever saw, the best food, the best restaurant I ever saw, the best this, and those best whatever become, as I say, less frequent. The only way you can keep on setting records is your ears continue to set the to grow and the record size, but that's not a whole lot of consolation.
John, it's been an extremely enjoyable experience to talk with you. As I was looking forward to this interview because I'd read a couple of your earlier books, and not just A Numerate Life, which is the one that we're talking about now, but some of the previous ones. And I'm just glad that I had the opportunity to conduct this interview. And I'd like to know if you have a website and how the listener can contact you.
Yes.
Other than follow you on Twitter along with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. My website is johnallenpaulos.com. Allen is A-L-L-E-N, Paulos, P-A-U-L-O-S, but one word, johnallenpaulos.com.
John, what's the title and subtitle of your book once again?
The title is A Numerate Life, and its subtitle is A Mathematician Explores the Vagaries of Life, His Own and Probably Yours.
John, it was definitely some of my life as well. Anyway, I enjoyed talking to you. Best of luck in the future.
I enjoyed it as well. Thanks very much, Jim.